Or maybe you had a friend do a tarot card reading for you. Or maybe you got the newspaper this year and you looked through and flipped through to see what your horoscope would be for 2018. I'm betting that a lot of you probably know your astrological sign. They tell me that I'm supposed to be an Aries. We're supposed to be wild hotheads. I don't know whether that fits me or not. Well, if you're into this kind of stuff, I'm betting it's probably not something you've talked a lot about at church, because it's not really something that good Christians are supposed to do. Good Christians don't rely on astrological signs to make our decisions for us. At least that's what many of us learned growing up, right? Well, what if I told you that some astrologers actually correctly predicted the biggest event of all time? Well, today is Epiphany, and according to the church calendar, this is the last day of the Christmas season. Many other churches actually celebrate Christmas today. This is the day that we celebrate when the three kings arrived with their gifts to worship the baby Jesus. You know these guys. They're in every nativity scene, right? But, of course, they're not actually kings. They're magi. Magi are astrologers. And by the way, we don't know for sure that there were three of them either. These guys are people from the East, maybe Persia or even Babylon. But they're definitely not Jews. They don't know much about the Jewish religion. They're complete outsiders. These guys study the stars to try to predict future events. It's actually very un-Jewish, un-Christian sort of a thing to do. The Jews are supposed to trust God for their future. They're not supposed to consult the stars. But the Magi don't know that. They're not Jews. They just do what Magi have always done. And one night, they're outside, looking up at the sky, studying the stars, and they see a new star rise up in the west. According to their religion, this means that a new king, a new leader will be born to the Jews, someone totally unlike anyone they've ever seen. These Magi take that sign very seriously. So seriously, in fact, that they make the decision to travel on foot on an epic journey from their homeland in the east, some hundreds, maybe thousands of kilometers, all the way to Jerusalem to see this new king for themselves. I've been told this journey could have taken a couple of years. Now remember, these guys are not Jews. They have not studied the Torah. They don't know all the Jewish prophecies about the coming of the Messiah. So when they finally arrive in Jerusalem, they make what must have seemed like a logical assumption. In the kids' Christmas pageants that we always see, the wise men follow the star all the way to Bethlehem. But they did not actually do that in the scriptures. What they actually do is, they go straight to the palace, and they request an audience with King Herod. Now, of course, Herod is the ruler that the Roman emperor has placed in charge of Judea. The Magi don't know Herod. They don't know his true character. Maybe they're a little bit naive. But it seems to make sense to them that the old king would know the whereabouts of the new king. That's how dynasties are supposed to work, right? The kingdom passes down from the old ruler to the new ruler. But Herod is an evil guy. He's not interested in what's good news for the kingdom. The possibility of a new king is a threat to Herod's power, and he knows it. So what does Herod do? He lies, like a good politician. He tells the Magi, "I'm going to help you find this new king so that I can go and worship him too." And in the meantime, Herod calls for a conference. He gathers together the top scholars of the Jewish religion. Now, these are guys who've studied the Torah and the prophets their entire lives. These guys are the religious experts. And they tell Herod that the prophecy says the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. When Herod gets this information, he calls the Magi back and he tells them, go to Bethlehem to look for the baby there. And then when you find him, come back and tell me where he is so I can go and worship him too. But actually, Herod is looking for the intel he needs to find the threat and eliminate it. He's manipulating the Magi. He's using them to his own advantage. So I think we get the picture here. Herod is not a nice guy. In fact, he's a pretty terrible human being. He commits genocide. He's powerful, he's ruthless, he will stop at nothing in order to get what he wants. But here's the really crazy part. God actually uses this horrible guy in order to accomplish something good despite himself. It's actually Herod who helps the Magi find the baby Jesus. Would they have found Jesus without Herod's help? We don't know. Now let's be clear, this does not mean that the horrible things that Herod does are somehow okay. Absolutely not. Herod's actions are utterly indefensible. But what this does mean, though, is that even in the middle of a completely dark and hopeless situation, when corruption seems to rule the day, when the people of God are living under an oppressive, dark regime, a regime with the blood of genocide on its hands, God does not abandon his people. God was still working, even in that situation, to create hope. Even when a terrible ruler like Herod seems to have all the power, even when darkness seems to be in control, God is quietly subverting the darkness behind the scenes. We've probably all had some pretty dark situations in our lives, times when it seemed like the powers of darkness were in control, and times where it seemed hard to find God because of that. Times where we wondered whether God was really still there at all. The Christian tradition calls this the dark night of the soul. Over the past few weeks, our church community has experienced many deaths, including Matt Dirksen's death, which was very untimely and tragic. It's a horrible thing for us to try to come to terms with. It's just really hard. And there is no easy way through these really hard times. There is no easy way through the dark night of the soul. You have to keep walking. Keep taking things one step at a time, one day at a time. But even during times of darkness, God does not leave us without hope. It's like following a star in the night. The Magi traveled for a long time, years perhaps, and I'm sure that there were nights when they couldn't see the star at all. There must have been times when the sky was completely covered over by clouds, completely dark. But they still just kept on walking. The same thing is true for us today. Even if you can't feel God's presence, God is still there. God does not abandon us just because we can't feel God. The sky may be covered with clouds, but the stars are still shining. They're still there, even on the nights that we can't see them. It's a normal part of the human experience to feel like God is absent sometimes. It happens. It's part of life. Even Jesus himself felt this way. While he hung on the cross, Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? There's no shame in that feeling. But even if you can't feel it, God is still there. God never leaves us nor forsakes us. And sometimes God shows up in ways that can surprise you when you least expect it. Sometimes the wind blows and it drives away those clouds and you can see the stars again. Now, nobody would have expected that the Magi, of all people, would have been the ones to find Jesus. They were the wrong religion. They were astrologers. That was not a Jewish practice. But that didn't matter. They just kept on going, despite everything, despite all of that. And God blessed their perseverance. At the end of the day, it's not the super famous religious people or the elite scholars or the powerful temple people who somehow find Jesus. It's the random group of pagan astrologers. It's actually the people on the outside who end up being the first to find God. Now the Magi brought three gifts to Jesus. They brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh. In the Old Testament, frankincense was used during temple worship. It was used like a kind of incense during offerings. They would burn it along with other offerings, and the smoke would drift up into the air. And so frankincense became like a symbol of lifting things up to God in prayer. The smell of frankincense became associated with worshiping God, with giving up things to God and letting go of things to God. So today, I'd like to give you an opportunity to do something. If there's something on your heart that you feel like you would like to offer up to God today, I'd like to invite you to have an opportunity to do that. And it can be anything. It can be whatever it is that you need to bring to God. It might be healing from grief, or it might be healing from physical pain, or maybe it's a relationship that you're concerned about, or financial problems, or something that's just going on in your life. Or it might even just be a longing for more, a longing to experience more of God. Whatever that is for you, I'd like to invite you to bring that to God this morning. We're gonna have an opportunity now where Jim and I are gonna stand up here at the front, and we both have some oil that actually has frankincense in it, so you'll smell it. It smells like frankincense. And we'll make the sign of the cross either on the back of your hand or on your forehead, depending on what you feel comfortable with, and we'll pray for you. And you can tell us what you'd like us to pray for if you want, or if not, that's okay. You can keep it private because God already knows about what it is. And even if you choose not to come forward today, that's okay. I still want to invite you, just between you and God, to bring whatever it is that's on your heart this morning that you need to bring to God to do that. But I'd like to invite everyone to come forward if you wish, and we'll pray for you. You can do that now. And as we do that, we'll have Barbara do some pieces on the organ for us. And then when we're finished, we'll close in prayer and we'll sing a hymn together.